From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Tribal Wisdom and the Modern World, we'll talk to David Mayberry Lewis. He's the founder of Cultural Survival, an organization that helps indigenous peoples whose ways of life are threatened by development. He hosts a new PBS series called Millennium that premieres tonight. Also today, how political polls reflect and manipulate public opinion. We talk with David Moore, a pollster who's written a new history of the subject. And we remember jazz singer Sylvia Sims. She died yesterday at the age of 74, just as her performance at the Algonquin Hotel ended. We'll hear a 1988 interview with her. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Members of the European Community have agreed to pull their diplomats out of Belgrade. They are angry over Serbia's involvement in the fighting in Bosnia. NPR's John Edstey reports from London.
The action by the European Community is an attempt to diplomatically isolate Serbia, which is now being singled out as the main instigator of the war in Bosnia. The Serbian-controlled Yugoslav army is aiding local Serbs in Bosnia, who are fighting Croatians and Muslims for control of the newly independent country. 1,300 people have died in the war so far, and more than 500,000 are homeless. At their meeting in Brussels today, the EC foreign ministers also agreed that there is no validity to claims by Serbia and its ally Montenegro to be the legal successors of the old Yugoslavia. And the foreign ministers called for the suspension of Yugoslavia from the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. The CSCE is a 52-member organization dedicated to mutual security and human rights. Last week, the United States called for similar action. I'm John Itzty in London.
In Germany, private industry now faces a round of demonstration strikes as union leaders in the country raise the stakes in their demand for higher pay. German government workers recently won a 5.4% pay increase, a rate higher than private business leaders say they are willing to offer their workers. William Horsley of the BBC reports.
Today's lightning strikes at several large electronics plants in Bavaria were a foretaste of the massive disruption of German heavy industry, which the unions say will begin in days. The last chance for a compromise appeared lost as engineering employers in the Frankfurt region confirmed they would not increase their 3.3% pay offer. Chancellor Kohl, who earlier swore he would keep the public sector settlement to less than 5% but was forced to eat his words, today told political and economic leaders from eastern Germany that wage settlements in private industry must be held down. Otherwise, the stability of the Deutschmark would be threatened, as well as the much-needed investment funds for the eastern part of the country. New trade figures showing record German exports in March gave the Chancellor his first heartening news for some time. But now employers in German car and electronics firms are preparing for strikes and lockouts, and the stage is set for a bruising confrontation.
William Horsley in Bonn. State Department officials have announced that the U.S. has imposed sanctions on both Russian and Indian enterprises for a deal they arranged involving the sale of booster rockets. According to a U.S. spokesman, these enterprises were not consistent with the guidelines of an international group that attempts to curb sales and sensitive military information. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 28 points to close at 3,397.58. A record in only moderate trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, Democrats have issued a call to the White House to work on ways to help the nation's inner cities. In a letter to President Bush, Democrats said that recent rioting in Los Angeles stressed the need for long-term plans to meet fundamental problems in many U.S. cities. The statement proposed full funding of the 1991 Surface Transportation Act, an approval of a crime bill stalled in the Senate that President Bush has threatened to veto. In Texas, a judge has delayed the execution of a Mexican national convicted of murder in a case that has touched off an uproar inside Mexico. NPR's John Burnett reports.
30-year-old Ricardo Aldape Guerra was scheduled to die by lethal injection at midnight tonight for the 1982 slaying of a Houston policeman. But State Judge Woody Denson postponed the death sentence until September on the request of prosecutors who say they want to examine new evidence that questions Aldape's guilt. The case case has gotten considerable attention in the Mexican press, which maintains that Aldape is innocent and is the victim of racism. Mexican President Carlos Salinas de Gortari sent a letter to Texas Governor Ann Richards on Saturday asking her to grant clemency to Aldape. Mexicans have also protested at the U.S. consulate in Aldape's hometown of Monterrey, and on Saturday about 300 people blocked the international bridge between Reynosa, Mexico and Hidalgo, Texas. Judge Denson said he would review the case and either recommend a new trial to an appeals court or proceed with the execution. In Austin, I'm John Burnett.
Three people mountain climbing on Mount Hood in Lausanne Saturday have been found. A spokesman says the three are healthy and dry. The climbers had been lost during a sudden storm after reaching the peak of the 11,000-foot mountain. On the way back down, they became lost from the rest of their group. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new series about tribal cultures begins this evening on public television. The series, Millennium, is about what the modern world can learn from tribal peoples. My guest is the host of the series, David Mayberry Lewis. He's a professor of anthropology at Harvard, who for many years has studied the native peoples of North and South America. What he saw happening led him to become a human rights advocate as well as a scholar. In 1972, he and his wife founded Cultural Survival, an organization that defends the rights of indigenous societies around the world as their lands and their ways of life are threatened by development. David Mayberry Lewis wants to help tribal societies control their own destinies in the face of development, but his goal is not cultural preservation.
What we mean by cultural survival, the concept and the idea, as opposed to cultural survival, our organization, is simply an effort to allow people to make the decisions that relate to their own future. So that if a tribal society wants to preserve some kind of a core of its own culture, then we feel that it's up to us to try and help them to do that. And it is absolutely not about preserving some sort of culture trait. People so often come and say to me, these indigenous peoples, they're not really Indians, are they? They don't go around hunting with bows and arrows anymore. To which one has to reply, well, we don't ride around on horseback on the range anymore. Does that mean to say we're not really Americans? Obviously not. All societies change. Our own society has changed. When the founding fathers were writing the Constitution, they didn't imagine this enormous country where the majority of people live in the suburbs. But we're no less American for all that. And tribal peoples can make similar adjustments and hang on to their cultural core. And that's what cultural survival is all about.
I think there is this interest in saving tribal cultures as they are. Because it's an interesting mirror for other people to look at. Do you know what I mean? To kind of see a really, really, really earlier version of themselves and to have something to measure ourselves against. We look at tribal cultures as being kind of pure, untouched by modern civilization, untouched by technology, and so on and so on and so on. And that if they lose that, then we lose a part of ourselves.
Well, of course, they're not totally pure, but they are different. And they, too, are changing. They're not static. And they're not, and it's very important to remember this, they're not sort of earlier versions of ourselves. Because the other side of thinking that tribal societies have sort of retained some sort of pristine innocence is the other opinion that you hear much more frequently, and that is that tribal societies are societies that in some sense have flunked out. They haven't made it on the evolutionary ladder, and therefore they're backward. And therefore, you know, if terrible things happen to them, that may be sad, but it's kind of inevitable. And that's untrue, too, because in fact these are societies which have taken the roads that we did not. They're societies which have made and continue to make different choices. If they had all of our technology, they would still organize their lives differently.
For one of the shows, you wanted to film the Mashco Piro of Peru, and they're a hidden tribe. They, with the exception of a couple of people, they've really never emerged from the jungle, and they've never been visible to outsiders. Why did you want to include them in the series?
Well, for a number of reasons. In the first place, I'm not sure they haven't ever emerged. I suspect that the Mashco Piro probably had disastrous contacts with the rubber gatherers in Peru at the beginning of this century. In the Peruvian Amazon, those people were real sadists, and they went out and they would hold the families of indigenous people, indigenous men, hostage while they sent the men out into the jungles to gather rubber. And then as the men came in, they would be whipped to death at the whim of the overseer if they thought that the rubber hadn't, if they hadn't gathered enough rubber or so on. And all of this was done in what can only be described as a concentration camp system. It was a chamber of horrors. And that all happened in the first decade of this century. Now, I suspect that the Mashkupiro were probably suffered. They were probably involved in that, and they probably suffered at that time. And that is why they have penetrated into the jungle and now don't want to come out. The mystery is the three women. These are Mashkupiro women. We know that because of the accounts of the neighboring peoples, the neighboring indigenous peoples, like the Machigenga. And these three Mashkupiro women have been wandering along the banks of this river for quite a long time. They've been seen repeatedly in the past 8 years, and yet they don't either go back and disappear into the jungle, nor are they joined by other people from their own society. So what are they doing there? And we wondered if the Mashkupiro were beginning gingerly to wonder about coming out and joining the rest of us in this world. And if so, we were very worried about what would happen to them when they did. Because normally, when very isolated peoples come out like that, they're immediately afflicted by all sorts of diseases which we have developed immunity to, and they don't have that immunity. So that the important thing is to have some sort of medical system in place in these very remote areas that could inoculate them and give them a chance of physical survival.
So you were hoping to find these three women.
Indeed.
And film them and, if possible, communicate with them.
Well, it wasn't so much that we wanted to go up there and communicate with the women. We wanted to go up there and find out about the Mashkupiro.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to help the Peruvian authorities get a medical system in place to help the Mashkupiro if and when they emerged.
You're pretty confident that at some point they will want to emerge.
I'm sure that they'll have no choice about it.
Mm-hmm. Because the jungle is disappearing.
Exactly, and because, you know, over time people will move in and over time they will get curious and eventually there will be a contact.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point was very much a cultural survival point. I'm now talking about cultural survival, the organization. The point was to have some sort of a system in place to help these people to make that transition. Then, of course, there came the whole drama of should we film them, shouldn't we film them. After all, many people have taken pictures of the Mashkupiro women. And we felt if we saw them, this would be interesting to the outside world, we should take pictures of them too. But then we ran into trouble with our indigenous friends in the Peruvian indigenous organizations. Because although the local organization had no problem with this, their representatives came down from the Lima organization that said, well, wait a minute, you're letting a film crew go into these remote regions and you're going to allow them to photograph the Mashkupiro women? That's an unwise thing to do, because you can't trust filmmakers. And the other said, well, why not? I mean, we've worked with these people in cultural survival. We know they're trustworthy. Whereupon the representative from Lima said, ah, yes, but you don't have our experience. We worked with Herzog. We've been extras in his movies, and we know that filmmakers will promise you anything when they're actually in the field, and then they go back to the cutting room, and they'll cut the film in ways which you can't imagine, and they'll make you out to be savages. They'll do what they like. You don't have any control.
Well, the German filmmaker Werner Herzog, to who you refer, made
That's
two
right.
films in Latin America, Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and Fitzcarraldo.
Yes.
What exactly did he do? How exactly did he use indigenous peoples there that earned him such an unfavorable reputation?
Well, I can't really say too much about that because I don't know what he did. All I can tell you about is the reaction from our indigenous friends in Lima.
Mm-hmm.
Who said that on the basis they claimed of their experience with Herzog, but that may or may not have been the real reason for their saying this. They said, you can't trust filmmakers because they'll promise you one thing when they're in the field, and then they'll go back and do another thing in the cutting room, and you have no control over what they do. So then we had a sort of an impasse. We said, well, we really are trying to go up there and help to set up these medical systems, and we think that this film will actually enlighten the world and bring a greater sensitivity to the problems which all of you people are facing in the jungle. But the Our Indian friends said, yes, but how do we know that you aren't going to go chasing through the jungle just trying to find uncontacted peoples to get dramatic footage for your audience? And we said, well, we can guarantee that's not what we're going to do. And they said, well, we're not sure if we really believe you, because once you get out there, you know, your filmmaking instincts will take over, the thrill of the chase, etc., etc. So finally, we made an agreement with them. We said, look, if we should happen to see the Mashkupira women, we assure you that we're not going up there to sort of chase through the woods looking for them. But if we should happen to see them, let us photograph them, for goodness sake, because everybody has photographed them. It would be silly if we held off. But we promise that we won't go over and follow up in any kind of way. And they said, all right, if you'll do that, this is okay with us. And when we went up the river, in fact, we took two representatives, one of the local indigenous organization and one of the national one from Lima, and they traveled with us on the trip. And we did, in fact, as you noticed, we did, in fact, meet the Mashkupira women. And this was a very poignant and very painful moment for me personally, because my first reaction as we saw them was tremendous excitement and emotion. I thought, this is why I got into anthropology. The hope of going beyond the edges of our world, like an astronaut, only I'm traveling laterally instead of out into outer space, going outside of our world, meeting people who really are so different from us that there's hardly any point of contact between their culture and ours, and trying to understand how they look at the world, trying, in fact, to bridge the gap between them and us and to bring this understanding back to my own people. This was what I thought anthropology was all about when I first got into it. But then my next feeling, I mean, that all went through my mind in a flash, my next feeling was, but there's going to be no meeting. We have given our word that we will not go over so much as talk to these women. Now, thinking about it, of course, what could we have done? I didn't speak their language. They didn't speak mine. If I went over to talk to them, it would have been a sort of a dialogue of the deaf. But it would have been a human gesture. They would have understood that we were friendly, we were trying to make contact. We would have understood that if they had responded. There would have been some human contact. As it was, we kept our promise. We took some pictures. They waved at us. We waved at them. But I felt like a voyeur. I felt like somebody who was treating them as if they were in the zoo. And that was very painful.
My guest is David Mayberry Lewis. He's a professor of anthropology at Harvard, and he's the founder and president of Cultural Survival, an organization devoted to helping tribal societies control their own destinies. And he hosts a new public television series called Millennium. He's also the author of a companion book called Millennium: Tribal Wisdom and the Modern World. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Mayberry Lewis is my guest, the host of the new public television series Millennium and the author of a companion book. As part of your work for this Millennium series, you returned to the Xavante of Brazil. This was the first indigenous group that you ever studied as an anthropologist.
Right.
You first went there 30 years ago. And when you went there, this group had a reputation in Brazil for being ferocious. What had earned them that reputation?
Well, it was simply because the frontier, the Xavante, had moved away from the advancing Portuguese frontiers of settlement in the early 19th century. And they'd moved right out into central Brazil, into a sort of a no-man's land, where they were left alone. And then the settlers caught up with them again in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and the Xavante fought back. So that in the 40s and early 50s, when small planes used to fly over Xavante villages, they would look down and take photographs of these tall, well-muscled men racing out of their huts and firing arrows into the air at the overflying planes. So the Xavante got this great reputation as being the tough Indians of the interior. But the professor from whom I learned my first lessons in Brazilian anthropology, Professor Herbert Baldus at the University of São Paulo, my wife and I studied with him. And Baldus wrote a very important article in one of the major São Paulo newspapers entitled, "Are the Xavante Bellicose?" Well, as you can imagine, he came to the conclusion that they were not. The Xavante were simply doing what anybody might be expected to do. They were defending themselves. Well, that was fine, and I believed Baldus, and I'm happy to say we discovered that he was quite correct in our later years with the Xavante. But at the time when we were planning to visit them, it wasn't at all clear that they would understand that my wife and I, when we went to visit them, that we were not bellicose. We put down, it was a Brazilian Air Force plane which flew us to a little airstrip which had been established by an advanced post of the Indian Service, an attraction post, which was trying to persuade the Xavante to come in and make peaceful contact with the outside world. And there was, in fact, one Xavante village which had established itself fairly close to this attraction post. And there was a little airstrip there. So this Brazilian Air Force plane put down and left the propellers running. It was a little Beechcraft. Bundled my wife and myself and our small son out onto the airstrip, a little bit hastily, I thought, threw our bits and pieces and all our expeditionary gear and all the presents that we'd bought for the Xavante out onto the airstrip and said, "We want to get out of here before the Indians arrived," and took off.
And they just left you there.
And that left us in it's the loneliest moment I can remember in my whole life, really. We were standing there, the three of us, two and a half, with our bits and pieces now looking pathetically inadequate around our ankles. And the Xavante, the young men, of course, since they run fastest, were running into the airstrip. They arrived at the end. We could see them loping towards us, looking like ancient Greek athletes. They had their hair flying out behind them. They were stark naked, well-built. And they raced up to us and gathered around us and immediately started pointing at the carrying sling, which my wife was carrying the baby in, because it was woven by the Xavante, and it was a type of weave, a palm weave, which they also use and which they recognized. And then, with much trepidation, I said my first words to them in Xavante, and I said something like, you know, "Can you help us pick up these things and carry them to your village?" And to our intense relief, they burst out laughing, because they'd never expected anybody who literally dropped in on them out of the sky to say something, anything, intelligible. And they could at least understand me. But I spoke funny. I didn't speak Xavante, I spoke Xavante. So they thought this was hilarious. And they gathered up our bits and pieces, and we were taken in with much rejoicing. And later on, I became a kind of a buffoon in their society. You know, the way I spoke was funny, what I did was funny, the questions I asked struck them as intensely amusing.
But that made you non-threatening.
And exactly. And my incompetence was also funny. The fact that I couldn't follow a trail. Because when Xavante wander off through the forests, they don't set out together. One man just goes off, and then his friend goes off a few minutes later and follows the first man's trail. But I couldn't do that, because I couldn't follow a trail. And the Xavante found this absolutely incredible. I mean, a grown man who seems to have his wits about him, and he can't follow a trail that is so broad that any Xavante child could follow it. So they realized that amongst them, I was really like a baby in arms and had to be looked after. And they looked after me, and that was very nice.
So you returned to the Xavante recently for the Millennium series. Did you let them know that you were coming, and did you ask permission to come with a film crew?
Oh, yes, very definitely. It wasn't the only time I'd been back to the Xavante since those early days. I had been back to them once or twice before. Then there had been a long period when I didn't go back. And then I started going back to the Xavante again in the early 80s. And when the Millennium series was being made and we wanted to go back and film among the Xavante, I made a special trip to the Xavante, and I got up in the men's circle, as is customary, and asked formal permission of the elders of the village to come with a film crew and make the film.
Did they know what a film crew was, what a film was?
Oh, yes. By this time, a lot of Xavante have been out in the outside world, and they have experience with film crews. Not everybody. There are Xavante there who didn't really know what it involved, but there are other Xavante who are very sophisticated, who've been to the big cities, who've lived in the big cities. And in this particular village, there was much discussion about the film crew coming, whether they should be allowed to come, what we should pay them to be allowed to make the film. And finally, the Shavanti settled on a payment of 150 head of cattle. And the Millennium producers decided that that was reasonable. It was rather expensive, but reasonable. And so we made a deal with them that we would come back the following year, make the film, and deliver 150 head of cattle for the privilege. The only problem with that was that when we came back the next year, our film crew had a fixer, as film crews customarily do, arranging things in Brazil, you know, arranging all the logistics, which are very complicated, of getting this crew from place to place. And it was the fixer's job to arrange to buy 150 head of cattle up in the interior. Now, I suspect that our fixer was more accustomed to taking film crews to Copacabana Beach than he was to buying cattle in the interior. So he made a deal with a local rancher to buy 150 head of cattle, but before we actually got up there, the price of cattle went through the roof. So surprise, surprise, when we get into Shavanti country, the rancher says, "Oh my goodness, I didn't think you were coming. I've sold all the cattle I was holding for you, and of course I could try and gather another herd together for you, but that'll be a quite different price." I suspect that he just didn't want to sell at the old price. Anyway, so we were stuck. We were up there, we were with the Shavanti, and now we were going to have to pay double what we'd originally estimated for this herd of cattle. And
I could just see you putting this in your end-of-the-year budget analysis.
Well, our poor Michael Grant, one of the producers, was with us, and he went white since he was trying desperately hard to control costs. And you know, controlling costs when you're making films is virtually impossible. So he sort of turned to me and he said, "Well, David, you know, the Shavanti will understand, won't they, that the price has doubled, and so we perhaps can only afford half as many cattle." I said, "Michael, they won't understand at all. Shavanti are not interested in price. Our deal was 150 steers. That's what they'll expect." So Michael swallowed hard, and we bought the 150 head of cattle at twice the original estimated price, and he just had to deal with it in his budget.
I wonder if there's anything that you would most like to have that you don't have, but you found that people in tribal cultures do have. A sense of, you know, a sense of family or a sense of connection to the earth or whatever. I don't know what it would be. I'm thinking of
Well, in one word, I could put it, sum it up in one word, it's connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
These people have a sense of connectedness, a connectedness to the cosmos, a connectedness to the earth, and a connectedness to each other, which I find beautiful and enviable. Our civilization has prospered by analyzing, breaking things down, taking things to pieces. But somehow we haven't been so good at putting it all together again.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
My guest has been David Mayberry Lewis, professor of anthropology at Harvard, founder of Cultural Survival, and host of a new public television series called Millennium, and also the author of the companion book, Millennium, Tribal Wisdom in the Modern World. And the Millennium series begins this evening on most public television stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the super pollsters. David Moore is a pollster who has written A History of Political Polling. We'll discuss how political polls both measure and manipulate public opinion. Also, we remember jazz singer Sylvia Sims. She had a heart attack yesterday just as she was finishing a performance at the Algonquin Hotel. Her nightclub career spanned 51 years. Foremost among her admirers was Frank Sinatra, who produced and conducted one of her albums. We'll hear a 1988 interview with Sylvia Sims. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Space Shuttle astronaut Pierre Thewitt is trying to catch a wayward communications satellite. Thewitt is on the end of the Shuttle Endeavour's robot arm with a grappling tool for grabbing the satellite. If Thewitt can get hold of the satellite, the astronauts will repair it so it can break out of the useless low orbit that it's fallen into. An attempt to capture the satellite yesterday failed. This time the astronauts are trying while the orbiters are on the sunny side of the Earth because Thewitt said yesterday darkness hampered his efforts. The president meets with community leaders in Philadelphia today to highlight his plan for American cities. Robbie Harris of member station WHYY reports.
President Bush visited one of the most blighted sections of the city today to hear from community leaders. Most came from areas slated to receive money under the president's Weed and Feed program, a plan to step up law enforcement and community development. Florence Richardson is a member of a local task force receiving some money under the plan.
What I need to know from you is that since we are talking about a multi-million dollar business as far as the drugs are concerned, exactly how are we supposed to fight this kind of problem, especially talking about agencies, community agencies that deal with housing with limited funds?
The president responded by saying money is not the whole solution. He pointed to success with the kind of community police work initiated by outgoing Commissioner Willie Williams. After the meeting, Mr. Bush headed for a fundraiser at a Philadelphia hotel. For National Public Radio, I'm Robbie Harris in Philadelphia.
A new round of multilateral talks aimed at resolving the Middle East's regional problems is getting underway. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
More than 20 delegations, Arab, Israeli, European, and Asian, are in Washington, D.C. to discuss Mideast arms control. The State Department describes the session as a seminar at this stage rather than negotiations. A seminar to describe methods of arms control, the history of the U.S.-Soviet hotline, and ways to build mutual confidence between antagonists. But three of the region's major military powers are not in Washington. Syria will not attend until Israel returns land captured in 1967. Iran, said to be developing its own nuclear weapons, is boycotting the talks, and Iraq is absent as well. Four other sets of Mideast regional talks are getting underway in other capitals, dealing with refugees, water, environmental concerns, and economic development. It's hoped that these multilateral talks will complement the separate peace talks that Israel is conducting bilaterally with its Arab neighbors. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Stock prices closed at a record high on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials gaining 28 points to close at 3397.58. Advances led declines by a margin of about 5-3. This is NPR. A report today says blacks are denied Social Security disability benefits more often than whites. The study comes from the General Accounting Office, a congressional investigating agency. The report says blacks consistently have been allowed benefits at lower rates than whites. The difference ranges between 4 and 13 percentage points. Senator William Cohen, the top Republican on the Senate Aging Committee, released the study. He says regardless of whether the difference in benefits is large or small, the racial discrimination that causes it must be wiped out. In Yugoslavia, Serbian authorities have reacted angrily to the European Community's decision to impose sanctions on the republic, warning that Serbs in both Croatia and Bosnia will continue their fight to remain part of Yugoslavia. Pierre Vickery reports that over the weekend at least 28 people were killed as the Serbian-controlled Yugoslav army continued its offensive in Bosnia.
Serbian state television said the package of sanctions agreed in Brussels was confirmation that the European community was not interested in a negotiated solution to the Yugoslav crisis. The Serbian leader in the Republic, Dr. Karadzic, called for the urgent resumption of the Lisbon peace talks, saying he would shortly be announcing a unilateral ceasefire by Serbian-led forces in Bosnia. In the Republic itself, heavy fighting continued as Serbian troops pounded the capital Sarajevo with rockets, tanks, mortars, and heavy machine guns. Yugoslav warplanes staged a series of bombing raids in the north and southwest of the Republic. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
A British court today freed a woman who was jailed 18 years ago for an Irish Republican Army bombing. Judith Ward was released after a court ruled that her confession was the result of mental illness. Ward was described in court as someone who had fantasized about the Irish Republican Army. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During every political campaign, we're inundated with polls. Not only are the media constantly conducting polls on the candidates are constantly conducting their own polls to assess their strengths and weaknesses, as well as their opponents, and to see which way the public is leaning on the issues. My guest David Moore is the author of the new book, Super Pollsters: How They Measure and Manipulate Public Opinion in America. Moore is a pollster himself. He directs the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire, where he's also a professor. His polling results have been picked up by all the TV networks and many newspapers and news magazines. Moore told me that the way candidates use pollsters has changed in the past 30 years.
What's changed dramatically, one of the major reasons it's changed is that the primary process has become so important. In 1960, when Kennedy was running for president, the primary process was used only to indicate the potential strength of a candidate. Kennedy didn't go into the convention having gone through all the primaries and won all the delegates. He went into a few primaries so that he could show that even though he was a Catholic, he had some strength. But by 1972, after the Democratic Party had gone through a major amount of reforms and made the primary season so important, then pollsters became important, because they were then used by the candidates, and one of the first candidates was George McGovern under this new system. The pollsters were used by the candidates to help the candidates figure out what messages would be most appealing to the electorate and where they should campaign, what primaries they should enter into, and so on. So it's really changed dramatically since John Kennedy ran 1960.
Let's look at today's presidential pollsters. The president's pollster is Robert Teeter, and he's working on this presidential campaign. He worked on Bush's previous campaign as well. Right. What has his strategy been in this campaign?
Well, Bob Teeter, even though he's been a pollster throughout the past two decades, is right now the campaign chairman of the Bush campaign. And the polling strategy has been mainly to determine what is the extent of the alienation that we see in the American public. I think it's clear from the Buchanan challenge that there's a great deal of alienation. And I think the polling has probably shown, and this is why we see Bush trying to cast himself as an agent of change, that people want some major change going on in government because they're tired with the way things are working right now, or not working.
Do you think it was Teeter who was responsible for the Willie Horton ads? I mean, not for creating the ads, but the impetus behind that type of ad.
Well, since the positives and negatives allow the pollsters to determine whether the ads work one way or the other, it's been very clear that the negatives of a candidate do go up if that candidate is being challenged or is the target of very strong negative advertising. In 1988, there were a series of items that Bob Teeter and that Lee Atwater, who was then the campaign chairman, wanted to test on the public. One of the items had to do with the Pledge of Allegiance, the mandatory Pledge of Allegiance bill that was vetoed by Governor Dukakis. Another one was the furloughing of Willie Horton. And through focus groups, which is a meeting of get-together of about 10 to 12 voters, and through subsequent polling, the campaign staff on the Bush side was able to determine that those two issues were very, very emotional issues for the public. And as a consequence, they then went after Dukakis. Now, the strategy was very clear, as Atwater said, based upon the polling that Teeter had done, that Bush's negatives were very high. Dukakis's positives were very high, and they knew they could not win the election campaign if they allowed that to remain. So what they wanted to do was raise the negatives of Dukakis, and the way they had to do that was engage in negative advertising, and they did.
My guest is David Moore, author of the new book Super Pollsters, and he directs the Survey Center of the University of New Hampshire. Now, Pat Kidell, a kind of former super pollster who temporarily gave up politics, was representing Jerry Brown, and I think he might have kind of switched camps to H. Russ Perot, or he's with both of them now. I'm kind of unclear.
Yes, it's unclear.
Now, what were some of his, some of the strategies he became best known for as a pollster?
Well, Kidell was really one of the first modern pollsters. After Lou Harris worked with John Kennedy, there was some polling done by presidential candidates. But in 1972, McGovern got a unknown undergraduate from Harvard University named Pat Kidell to work on his campaign for him. Pat Kidell was got into politics then because he was very much animated, he said, by the idealism of Robert Kennedy, and he felt that McGovern was the natural heir to that philosophy. And so Pat Kidell became the wunderkind of the time with his numbers and his explanation. His major contribution was not only the numbers that he got in polling, but the fact that he had a very keen sense of strategy and a keen sense of what the American public were thinking. Now, of course, he also worked for Jimmy Carter in 1976 and Jimmy Carter again in 1980. Now, he did get out of politics in 1986, and now he's been unofficially advising Jerry Brown. I guess he hasn't been doing polls for Jerry Brown, but unofficially advising him about the extent of alienation among the American public. Now, whether he's also advising H. Ross Perot, I don't know. I haven't picked that up from the press, but he did in a recent interview praise Perot's strategy for getting into the race more than he praised Jerry Brown.
Are there any classic examples of misuse of information on the part of candidates, pollsters?
Well, I think the classic example has got to be the one that Pat Kidell himself admits was a real distortion of democracy, or a real attempt to undermine democracy. In 1986, when he was working for Senator Alan Cranston in California, he devised a strategy that would make the campaign very, very negative, so negative that it would turn off younger voters from even going out to vote. And the reason he did that, he said, was that the younger voters were much more likely to vote for the Republican candidate than they were to vote for Alan Cranston. And by becoming very, very negative, he thought he could take a candidate who he felt really did not have majority support and still allow him to win. And ultimately, he was successful. Cranston won by 2 percentage points.
So, in other words, he wanted to make voters so disgusted with the whole process that they'd stay home because he thought Cranston would benefit by a low turnout.
That's right. And he was right. At least that's the way what he says. And we know that the results were very close. And he says as a consequence of that, by the way, that he decided to get out of political polling for money. Now, the fact that he's back in, he says, is free and just providing free advice to some candidates. But he did get out officially in 1986.
My guest is David Moore, and he's the author of the new book, The Super Pollsters. He's a pollster himself. He directs the Survey Center of the University of New Hampshire. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Moore is my guest, author of the new book, The Super Pollsters. I'm interested in hearing how you design a question so that it accurately measures somebody's opinion and the strength of that opinion. Say, for instance, you were designing a survey about public attitudes toward abortion. You could choose another subject if this one isn't a very good example. How do you phrase questions so that you know if you're really measuring it accurately?
Well, that's a really good example, Terry, because the question of abortion is one that is a very emotional one. It's been around for a long time, and you would think that people's views would be pretty stable on it. And yet the way in which the questions are worded can have an impact, even if pollsters don't anticipate early on that it's that the question wording is going to have an impact. It can. For example, if you ask a question like, do you think it should be legal or illegal for a woman to have an abortion under X number of circumstances, you get one kind of response. But if you say, do you think the state should prevent a woman from having an abortion? Using the words, have the state prevent a woman from having an abortion, will make people much more supportive of a woman's right to have an abortion than if you say, do you think it should be legal or illegal for a woman to have an abortion? People don't want the state to prevent. And it's really interesting because we've run some experiments where half of our sample was asked the question whether or not it should be legal or illegal, and the other half was asked whether the state should be prevent a woman from having an abortion. And we got on the order of 10 to 15 percentage points differences in support. So that's it's a very ticklish situation there when you're trying to come up with something or a question that's really objective, because you don't really know what's the proper way to phrase it.
So which way would you go with now?
Well, I think most pollsters these days are using, do you think it would be legal or illegal? Or do you think, would you support or oppose a bill that would make it legal or illegal? They use that kind of terminology rather than state preventing a woman having an abortion. Now, in fact, of course, the side that is pro-choice are people who often commission polls in which the more strict wording is used. And when that stricter wording is used, you get more people who support women's rights. And the question is, what's right and what's wrong? And the answer is, neither way of asking it is right or wrong. What you tap are different dimensions of the same issue. People are really opposed to the state interfering in a woman's right to have an abortion. On the other hand, they really don't want a woman to have an abortion if it's frivolous. And those kind of conflicting views are reflected then in sometimes in different results you get from slight wording in the questions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you know, you could easily make the argument that the state preventing a woman from having abortion is the more accurate depiction of what's happening, because if a woman wants an abortion and she can't have one, the state is preventing her.
That's correct. And you could also say that all the state is doing is making it illegal for a woman to have an abortion. You can use both phraseologies and it comes out to be the same. Let me give you another example. When we ask questions about whether people feel that there should be more or less money spent on welfare, that's one way to phrase it, or on assistance to the poor, that's another way to phrase it. Well, for welfare, there's very little support for more money for welfare, but there's about 40 or 50 points more support for assistance to the poor. Now, welfare and assistance to the poor should be considered identical in terms of what they do, but in terms of the word itself, welfare, having a very loaded connotation, it's so loaded that you just really can't use that word and get a meaningful response from the public.
I think it's fair to say that the American public has become really disillusioned with the abundance of polls, especially, you know, political ones. And obviously you think polls are valuable as a pollster yourself. And I wonder if you'd share with us what you think the values of political polling are.
Well, I think I'm sympathetic to those who say there are too many polls done by the news media, because oftentimes what happens is that instead of focusing upon issues, the press may instead focus upon the latest poll. And it's a part of a long process of focusing what's referred to as the horse race aspects of a campaign rather than upon the substantive or issue aspects. On the other hand, the problem with that criticism is that before there were media polls, the media were still interested in revealing to the readers the nature of the horse race, who's ahead and who's behind. And so if they didn't use their own polls, if they didn't commission polls, they would often take information from the campaign pollsters. As a matter of fact, Bud Lewis said that the major reason NBC went to doing its own polling was that in 1972 it felt completely manipulated by Pat Caddell working for George McGovern, who after every primary would talk about how much George McGovern had won the blue-collar vote. He said that just didn't seem likely. Here he was, a liberal Democrat winning the blue-collar vote. But they had no way to verify or to challenge that information. And as a consequence of this manipulation in the view of the press, they developed their own polls. So I think at least the media polls do provide a check And if there are enough of them, then all the polls have an incentive to be as accurate as possible and as objective as possible. So in that sense, I think they do provide good information, and they certainly do provide a check against manipulation by partisan groups.
David Moore is the author of The Super Pollsters. He directs the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear today from the foreign minister of Bosnia on his appeals to the United States to send a relief team, a military relief team, to Bosnia-Herzegovina to try to stop the fighting there. So far, he seems to have received moral support, but no commitments beyond that. Also, a report from NPR's John Burnett about H. Ross Perot and who the man is. And we'll also be talking with Emmett Terrell Jr., conservative columnist, about the conservative crack-up and the crisis that has befallen conservatism, which he sees as being supported only by the equally grave crisis afflicting liberalism.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Yesterday, cabaret singer Sylvia Sims died at the age of 74. She collapsed during a standing ovation at the Oak Room of the Algonquin Hotel in Manhattan, where she had just performed a program of songs associated with Frank Sinatra. Sylvia Sims was one of the cabaret singers most admired by other singers of her generation. Sinatra was among her greatest admirers and a close friend. We remember her today with an interview from June of 1988, recorded before she performed at a jazz festival in Philadelphia. First, some music from her 1982 album, Sims by Sinatra, which was produced by Frank Sinatra.
I look at you and suddenly something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. You and your glance make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night blazing their light. Your razzle-dazzle, you've got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride.
Sylvia Sims used to say she knew every brick on Manhattan's West 52nd Street, which was home to many jazz clubs in the 40s when she was getting started.
Everywhere there was a little cellar, they opened a saloon, okay? And night after night, you could go from one saloon to another and hear Art Tatum and Coleman Hawkins and Billie Holiday and Billy Eckstein and Billy Daniels and all of these fabulous people. I listened to a lady on the air from a remote. She was working at the Three Deuces. And the doors were wide open, and I stood outside of that club for three shows. After she finished her second show, there was a place called the White Rose Bar on the corner of 52nd Street and 6th Avenue, and all the musicians would finish their sets, and they staggered their sets so people could go from one to another to another to another, both sides of the street, you know? And so she came out of the club, and she saw me standing there, and she said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm listening to you."
This is Billie Holiday?
Billie Holiday. And she said, "Go inside." I said, "I can't." She said, "How old are you?" I said, 15. She said, "No, you can't." So she said, "Come with me." And she took me with her. And when she came back, she took me to the White Rose. And when she came back, she put me in the check room, where I became a very familiar figure.
Oh, because you were allowed to stay in the check room, even though you couldn't be in the club itself.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the musicians took you under their wing.
Oh, yeah. They didn't take me under their wing. They were just wonderful to me. First time I went uptown, lady said, "Do you want to go uptown?" I said, "Where's uptown? I never heard of uptown." Well, uptown turned out to be Harlem. It turned out to be exactly like 52nd Street was. There were all these wonderful little after-hours places that people went to. And it was there that I met Fats Waller, Thomas Waller. He taught me about swinging.
I've just been listening to recordings that you made in the early 50s on a box set called New York Cabaret Music.
Isn't that wonderful? On Atlantic. Yeah.
Did you record much then?
No, I had one album. No, I did about two albums on Atlantic Records.
And this music is excerpts from that album?
Yes. It's very interesting because a young man named Larry Cart, who writes in Chicago, wrote me a letter and he said, I can prove to you that what you're singing on T for Two is a tenor saxophone chorus of Lester Young's. And that's true.
Oh, it's a great recording. It's a great recording of it.
Why don't you picture me upon your knee with T for Two? Two for T, just me for you. I will be yours alone. There'll be nobody near us to see us or hear us. No friends or relations on weekend vacations. We won't have it known that we've got a telephone. Dear, the dawn will break and dial away.
You're in your late 60s now and still singing beautifully. Have you had to change either your approach to breathing or to phrasing as you've gotten older and as your range has gotten smaller?
Oh, yeah, I had. Oh, sure. But my range got smaller, and I got, I had to do a lot of things that are, if you'll forgive me, quote unquote, sounds again egotistical, intelligent things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that some years ago, I lost a portion of my lung to malignancy, and I suffer from emphysema and asthma. But the feeling, no matter what happens to your range, and no matter what happens to your physicality, and no matter what happens to your age, the quality of caring and the intent does not change.
Sylvia Sims, she died yesterday at the age of 74.
This will be my shining hour. Calm and happy and bright. In my dreams, your face will flower through the darkness of the night. Like the lights of home before me, or an angel watching o'er me. This will be my shining hour till I'm with you again.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, is the men's movement in conflict with the women's movement? We put this question to Robert Bly, one of the founders of the men's movement and the author of its most influential book, Iron John. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.